Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Conversations Live, where we bring you the best in music, books, entertainment, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us. Now, here is your host, Cyrus Webb.
And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Conversations Live, where we connect you with the artists and authors you love, who bring you the music and books you can't get enough of. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. I want to first thank those joining us here on the radio dial here on a rainy day here in Mississippi at 92.3 FM. We also welcome our listeners joining us along the world through blogtalkradio.com, who are tuning in either through our switchboard, our live chat, or even through our podcast. We're glad to have all of you with us as well. Today we have a very special guest that's joining us live. Lynn Stout is here to talk to us about her new book, The Shareholder Value Myth. Now, this is a book that, if you remember, I told you about it a couple of weeks ago for those who listened to us on the radio, because I thought it was one of those that might seem complicated, but the way that Lynn really breaks it down makes this a topic that all of us can understand. We've heard about this topic some in the news, especially because it is a political season, especially when it comes to the presidential campaign. But the subtitle of Lynn's book is How Putting Shareholders First Harms Investors, Corporations, and the Public, and Lynn really does a great job in breaking this down. She's joining us live to talk to us about what led her to write the book and what she hopes you as listeners are able to take away from it. Lynn, welcome to Conversations Live.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Cyrus.
Well, glad to have you on, Lynn. You know, when I first started reading this book, I have to be honest, I did not know exactly what to expect because of the fact I know it is one of those things that is not always the easiest to try to explain, and definitely not for people who don't actually live in this world all the time. You know, they may wonder, okay, what does this have to do with me? But I thought the way that you presented the book really helps us all to understand better. Exactly, for one thing, which was important for me, what the shareholder value myth was, and then, of course, how it was dispelled and what we actually should be looking at. So before we get into that, I think it's important for us to know a little bit more about your background, Lynn. I know that you're a corporate expert. Tell our listeners how you first came to the idea of writing this book.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I am a specialist in corporations, and I sympathize with your listeners. There aren't many people like me who wake up in the morning and say, oh, I want to go read about and think about corporate governance.
Right.
But I wrote the book because I think everyone can see. You don't have to be an expert to know. There's something going wrong in our economy.
Right.
And because I'm an expert in the business world, I was sort of in the thick of it, and I was seeing things that I was very troubled by. And I thought, you know, the one of the problems we face politically is that most people, because they're not experts and because they have their own lives to live and their own jobs to do, they don't follow this this ideology, this new ideology of shareholder value very closely. Many people probably aren't even aware of it. But
right.
I wrote the book because I was convinced it was doing enormous damage. And it's damage not just to investors, and anyone who owns stock knows we've not been getting great returns lately, but it's damage to customers, damage to employees, damage to the American society.
Right. And that is the great point here, Lynn. And this is why I think this is going to be great for our listeners, because there is the trickle-down effect, even though it might seem like something that they might not necessarily think involves them directly. It really does have an effect on them. What I did was, when I was going back through, because I knew I'd be speaking with you, Lynn, I tried to draw attention to certain passages that I think will really help us along this conversation. You are an expert at this, and that's why we're so glad that you could join us. But in Chapter 2 of the book, for those who haven't already, it's on pages 24 and 25, and I'm going to share a part of this because Lynn really helps us to kind of understand this relationship and how it may not be exactly how a lot of us think it is. This is what you wrote, Lynn, on page 24. The widespread perception that corporate directors and executives have a legal duty to maximize shareholder wealth plays a large role in explaining how shareholder value thinking has become so endemic in the business world today. But on page 25, you explain this. There is one fatal flaw in their reasoning. The notion that corporate law requires directors, executives, and employees to maximize shareholder wealth simply isn't true. There is no solid legal support for the claim that directors and executives in U.S. public corporations have an enforceable legal duty to maximize shareholder wealth. Now, that is something that most people will not know. When you discover that yourself, because you actually talk about in the beginning of the book how you felt like a lot of people felt, that that was just what they were supposed to be. They were there to, you know, be able to make their shareholders happy and to be able to, you know, to make sure that they're profitable. When you realize that was not the case, how did that change your perception of the whole system?
Well, first, it drove me crazy because everyone was saying that that was the rule, and that was even what I had been taught, at least should have been the rule. And there, when I was actually teaching corporate law myself and reading the actual cases, it became really obvious that wasn't the rule. And at first, it was just a puzzle that drove me nuts. And I actually thought maybe the law was wrong. You know, maybe the judges had been getting it wrong for all of these centuries and decades. But what happened was the more experience I got in the business world and the more I learned about it, the more I became convinced that actually the law was right. There's a reason why the law does not require directors of companies to outsource jobs just to raise profits a few pennies. There's a reason why the law does not require directors of companies to pay out huge dividends when that means there isn't enough money left for research and development or for designing great new products. There's a reason why, in fact, corporations traditionally were not subject to any sort of a rule they said had to maximize profits. And we're seeing that today because even though the law doesn't require directors and managers to maximize profits, a lot of them try to do that, in part because now they're compensated with stock options, so they personally make money if they do it. And what we're seeing is that strategy of focusing on always raising the share price is really bad for the overall economy and for consumers and employees and taxpayers.
Right.
And investors. Right. And investors, too. That's the terrible irony.
Yeah. And that is why, again, I really want our listeners to try to take this in, and we're going to be letting them know how they can get their own copy of the book. And the way that you lay it out, you make it so easy, and I think it's because you do live with this, so you're able to kind of break it down for us. You know, and this is where I think I was a little confused. When you listen to a lot of those that are in government especially, you would think they, as elected officials, know what they're talking about when it comes to, for one, of course, you know, how the economy works, and also what responsibilities are lying there when it comes to business and shareholders. Because we've heard a little bit of this, you know, because of the political season, especially in the presidential campaign. Do you think that a book like this, Lynn, will kind of give us all a little bit of pause and say, you know what, we need to really understand this better ourselves and not just take someone's word for it that may have it wrong, as you were taught it wrong?
Oh, Cyrus, you've described exactly what I'm trying to do in this book. I mean, the shocking thing is how there's either very little understanding of this among our business and our political leadership, or, and this is the cynical view, there are a lot of people who stand to personally benefit from deliberately misunderstanding it and perpetuating the myth. And they're not interested in taking a different approach to what the purpose of the corporation really is. And that's why I wrote the book. I thought, you know, no one wants to get up in the morning and educate themselves about the idea of shareholder value. But as a people, we kind of have to. We've created these entities we call corporations. They're enormously powerful. They bring us huge benefits, but also huge costs. And just the average person really can understand them. It's not that complicated. I'm not saying it's fun, but, you know, people are pretty savvy. People are pretty smart. They can understand this, and they need to, because if you just leave it up to our political leaders, they've made a pretty thorough botch of it. And sadly, that's on both sides of the aisle.
Exactly.
You know, there's plenty of blame to go around.
Right. I totally agree with that. And I just want to reset things for those that are just tuning in, either on the radio side of our program here in Mississippi or online through blogtalkradio.com. You're listening to Conversations Live. I have the privilege of speaking with Lynn Stout. Now, Lynn is a corporate expert that has really she has really done her due diligence on this topic, and we're discussing her book, The Shareholder Value Myth, how putting shareholders first harms investors, corporations, and the public, which means all of us that are listening to this program, no matter where you might be. And Lynn, what you've done, you know, I'm curious. Talk to us about the time, because like I said, you have really made this a lot easier to understand. How much time would you say it took you from beginning to end to kind of compile this information and then to make it so that, you know, laymen and women would be able to understand it the way that they are?
Well, interestingly enough, writing the book was easy. But it was only easy because I've been thinking about this issue and paying attention to the evidence for 20 years.
Okay.
And it took me that long. Now, in part, one of the things we need to recognize is that, you know, this isn't the way the business world has always operated. If you could get in a time machine and go back 50 years and talk to the executives and the directors at the what were then the great public corporations, the Xeroxes, the IBMs, the General Electrics, the General Motors, the AT&Ts, and if you were to say to them, what is the purpose of the corporation? What are you supposed to do in your job? What they would have told you is, we have lots of purposes. We're supposed to make great products. We're supposed to provide good, secure jobs for our employees, take care of our people. We're supposed to give a really good return to our investors. And we're supposed to be, and they actually would say this, we're supposed to be good corporate citizens.
Right.
We're supposed to support the nation. And that might very well include, say, actually paying some taxes instead of finding loopholes or, worse, lobbying to create loopholes. And that old attitude, we used to call it managerialism, and it really dominated the business world, but it broke down beginning in the 1970s and 1980s as this new ideology of share price above all else took hold.
You know, Lynn, one of the great things that you did in the book, and I want our listeners to know this, is that you have taken some of the assumptions that all of us have. And some of these, I have to say, and it goes back to something you said earlier, and I thought about it, I kind of smiled to myself. A lot of times you hear people talk about things, and you, I guess, in blind faith, take them for what they say because you think they know what they're talking about. You kind of break down these assumptions. That we sometimes have. On page 37, the first mistaken assumption is that shareholders own corporations. And I want to share just parts of two of the paragraphs that you mentioned here, Lynn, and we're going to talk about it. Laypersons and journalists and even the occasional economists like Milton Friedman often casually assert that shareholders own corporations. Sometimes even law professors who know better find themselves reflexively repeating the phrase. But from a legal perspective, shareholders do not and cannot own corporations. Corporations, they're independent legal entities that own themselves, just as human beings own themselves. And then you write this, what then do shareholders own? The label shareholder and stockholder give the answer. Shareholders own shares of stock. A share of stock, in turn, is simply a contract between the shareholder and the corporation, a contract that gives the shareholder very limited rights under limited circumstances. Then you give the great example, and I love this, and again, it goes to how you really help us to understand this. Owning shares in Apple doesn't entitle you to help yourself to the wares in the Apple store. You know, in explaining it that way, I want to talk about the response to this book, because just reading this chapter, that where you dealt with some of the assumptions and helping to us to understand how, you know, there are some who, for whatever reason, they repeat this to us, that it's very obvious when you look at it that it's not how it's been explained. What has been the response that you've gotten from people about, you know, when they find out what is the truth about this?
Well, what's interesting is I've been surprised at just how much of a positive response I've gotten from this book, and it's coming from two areas, interestingly. It's coming from what I think of as the long-term investor community, some of the pension funds and some of the institutional funds that really want the corporate sector to work in the long term and to generate good returns for investors in the long term. The other group, oddly enough, is from many business executives. And I have to tell you, you know, contrary to what you might believe from reading the newspaper, there are a lot of business executives out there who don't have horns and a tail. Now,
right.
You know, the banking industry may be special. Banking industry. But there are a lot of other corporate executives and business people out there who are very concerned because they understand that their firms are not doing a good job for society or their investors or their employees. But I'll tell you the people who hate this book, and there are a few, and they are especially the short-term investors, especially the hedge funds, Because what the book points out is that even though a lot of hedge, you know, what hedge fund managers like to do is they basically come in, they take a position in the shares of a firm, and then they put pressure on the managers of the firm to do things that are going to pump up the share price so they can sell and get out. And
right.
the problem is the strategies they push for are bad for the investors who stick around, they're bad for the employees, they're bad for the firm in the long run. But the short-term investors don't care, because if they can just get that share price up even by 5 or 10%, they can sell and make a profit and move on to the next target. And so I can tell you, those people really don't like this book, because what they've been able to get away with for 20 years is saying that they're the champions of all the rest of us, that somehow they represent the underdog shareholder, when actually their interests are very different from the interests of typical mom-and-pop long-term investors who are saving for retirement or to buy a house or maybe for a kid's college tuition.
In fact, Lynn, she takes a whole chapter in dealing with hedge funds versus universal investors in the book, chapter number 7. And I guess one of the things that gets me about this, Lynn, and it goes back to something we said earlier, and you mentioned, of course, you know, we could cynically say that people do know better and they just refuse to tell people the truth. If we were to keep up with that train of thought, you know, it really does make it then more incumbent on all of us, which is why, again, I think a book like this is important, for all of us to know. Because if we don't read for ourselves, don't look into this ourselves, and you've done a lot of the research for us, it's really just taking the time to read it and to be able to digest what it's saying, then we're able to better be, I think, equipped to make decisions that reflect the truth versus the perception that sometimes we're fed. When you talk about, of course, those that do appreciate the book, and I think we're going to focus on that because we like to be positive here, for those people, have you found that has, in many ways, planted seeds that continue to grow? And what I mean by that is they're then telling other people about it. Hey, you know what, we really need to look into this, or you should really look into this to better understand what's going on. Have you found that to be part of what's happening?
Yes, I have, and that's one of the reasons why I'm optimistic. Now, part of the reason why I think a lot of people are listening carefully is that we've seen what's happened to the corporate sector for the past 10 or 15 years, and I think a lot of people recognize there's a problem there. You know, we've had 20 years of saying the shareholder's king, we need more shareholder democracy, we need more, we need to pay executives to focus on raising the share price. It's now obvious to almost anyone who reads the newspapers that is not working out. So people really are willing to listen, and I do get the sense that they're talking to each other, the ideas are spreading, and that can make a big difference. I'd like to give you an example.
Sure.
There's an idea for a policy change that's floating around there. It's actually a couple of bills. I think Pete DeVries has got a bill in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, and Tom Harkin's got another bill in the Senate that would impose a sales tax, basically, on buying and selling stock. Now, 10 years ago, if you had suggested this, you can expect to have a whole bunch of economists and lawmakers get up and say, oh, we can't have a sales tax on trading stock. That's going to destroy innovation. It's going to drive trading offshore. It's going to hurt it's going to hurt Wall Street. It's just another bad tax. We should never do it. But now people are starting to understand that the reason why you might want to have a tax like that is, well, first of all, we need the revenue. I mean,
right,
if you
exactly.
tax the purchase of a car or a house, or even my favorite is, we're now going to start taxing the purchase of replacement joints for hip replacements. Well, if you're going to tax those things, why on earth would you not tax someone buying stock? But it's got this extra benefit. It'll discourage that short-term trading that is causing our companies to basically, eat their own future. That's one of the best things about that tax is it'll discourage the short-term hedge funds because now they can't make as much profit from buying and selling stocks quickly, from flipping the market. And that will encourage longer holding periods, which will give businesses more breathing room to take care of their employees, take care of their customers, and think for the long-term future and what it'll take to make the business sustainable and keep our economy healthy.
Exactly. Exactly. And that, again, shows why, especially now, it's important for us to pay attention to what's going on and to better understand this for ourselves. Again, Lynn Stout has been our guest, I mean, graciously taking her time. She's a corporate expert, but also the author of the book, The Shareholder Value Myth, How Putting Shareholders First Harms Investors, Corporations, and the Public. It's a fascinating book that it took me a little while to be able to settle into, Lynn, but only because I think I really wanted to make sure that I was getting the best understanding so that I could be able to have this conversation with you, and then, of course, to be able to share the information for our listeners here as well. But we do want them to know how they can get their own copy of the book. Lynn, let them know how to stay in contact with you as well as how they can get a copy of the book.
Well, you know, I'm an old-fashioned gal. I tend to stick to email and Google, but the book is easy to get a hold of. If you just Google the title or search the title, all sorts of options are available. It's at Barnes & Noble. It's at Amazon. It'll come right up. And my email is public, and I'm a professor at Cornell Law School, and I love to hear from people, especially I love to hear from business people. And you would be surprised how many CEOs and former CEOs have sent me emails saying, thank goodness you're saying this, because we don't like what we're being forced to do. We don't like having to, you know, fire employees and stop producing great products.
Yeah, and that is a part, again, of the national dialogue that's taking place right now, especially because of the time that we're in politically. So we definitely encourage people. You can actually get the book. It's on sale on Amazon.com as well. BarnesandNoble.com has it as well. The Shareholder Value Myth, again, is the title, How Putting Shareholders First Harms Investors, Corporations, and the Public. I love the bulls and bears scene that's going on the front there, Lynn. It is really a fascinating look, and I think it really helps us to understand what will happen if we don't start to rein this in. And so thank you so much for taking out the time to be with us and to discuss it with us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Cyrus. I really appreciate being invited to the conversation.
All right, well, we're glad to have you. Now, if you missed any part of my conversation with Lynn, don't worry. You can catch the entire podcast about 5 minutes after we go off the air by going to our website at www.conversationsliveradio.com. Again, that's www.conversationsliveradio.com. Or if you're friends with me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter, the link's available on both of those places right now. All you have to do is go to my page, click on the link, you'll be able to listen to it and download it completely for free. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're heading up to Massachusetts, where our resident chef, Bruce Treader, he'll be giving us our quick and easy cooking tip of the day. You're listening to Conversations Live here on the radio at 92.3 FM and online through blogtalkradio.com.